I'm San Francisco Chronicle columnist Heather Knight, and you're listening to Fifth and Mission. 2 people die every day on average from drug overdoses in San Francisco. Their bodies are taken to the San Francisco Medical Examiner's Office for autopsies. Dr. Luke Rada, the city's chief forensic toxicologist, helps examine them and count them. He recently started releasing monthly reports tracking the surge in drug overdose deaths. In October, there were 58. In the first 10 months of this year, there have been 563. That's a huge jump from 441 fatal overdoses in all of 2019. Rada joined me to discuss these alarming numbers and what the city should do about them. Dr. Luke Rada, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Heather.
You just shared some more startling numbers with me regarding drug overdoses in San Francisco and particularly deaths. There were another 58 deaths in October. So we're now in the high 500s for the whole year and probably on track to hit about 700 deaths from overdoses in 2020. What do you feel seeing those numbers that you're sharing with the city every month?
Yeah, it's, you know, on one hand, it's really interesting having the numbers, you know, in paper. We can see this. We feel it every day. This whole year and actually the last couple of years have been really challenging for us. And when we actually put this data together, it really demonstrates what we're feeling from a day-to-day basis. These numbers don't seem to be going down. They seem to be increasing. We're hoping that they will plateau at least soon. But yeah, these numbers really continue to increase in the manner that we feel that we're under pressure, you know, in the office. On a day-to-day basis.
So you're seeing on average about 2 bodies per day from drug overdoses, and that's been pretty true this whole year?
This throughout the 2020 year, as you mentioned before, we're tracking towards almost 2 a day. And that's total overdoses, and specifically overdoses relating to accidental deaths. So these are people mm-hmm. who weren't intending to die. They were using drugs, but they didn't intend to die. And this is, of course, opposed to other cases that we have, such as suicides or homicides or other natural diseases and cases that involve drugs. And so these, again, we think that over time they will continue to hopefully decrease with more interventions, but that's what we're feeling now.
And when did you really see this spike? I know it's climbed for the past few years, but when did it really jolt you, like, wow, we've got a really serious problem?
You know, really throughout 2017, we started to notice that we were getting double the amount of fentanyl deaths from the previous year in 2016. Now, it wasn't nothing like the numbers now. It was really from, say, a dozen deaths in 2016 to about 25 deaths in 2017. But that was enough to have an alert then. And we started to notice fentanyl being detected in cases with methamphetamine also on board or cocaine. And so we started to notice situations where potentially people are using these drugs either mixed with stimulants such as methamphetamine or crack cocaine or used interchangeably. And that's when we first started thinking that the opioid epidemic that the East Coast has been observing for some time and here on the West Coast in San Francisco had been, you know, not as affected by the East Coast. But at that point, we started thinking that maybe it's starting to come across over here.
Mm-hmm. And what are some of the telltale signs when a body comes in and you start examining it? How do you know that this person died of a drug overdose?
Yeah, you know, it starts really early. We have a team of investigators here who are 24/7. They respond to notifications of deaths all around the city and the county. And when they're on scene, they have a pretty good idea about if this death may be related to an overdose. They've seen enough of these. They're very well experienced. They witness and they interview either family or friends or witnesses, and they start to get a pretty good idea if this case might be a drug overdose of some sort. Now, what we don't know at that point is what is the drug responsible or drugs responsible. And so really the next morning. So every morning we have a morning meeting with the investigative team, and they bring the cases that have been received by their division over the last 24 hours, and they bring it to the medical and also the forensic laboratory divisions. And we sit down together and triage each case as it comes in from the previous 24 hours. We get another idea then about what the case might look like. The case then goes almost straight to autopsy that following morning. And that's when the medical examiner will start to perform their autopsy. They collect biological specimens, blood and urine from the decedent. And then it's our job in the forensic laboratory to start to test these biological specimens for drugs, alcohol, and poisons. And that's really, so there's signs all throughout, but really the final sign is when we get the toxicology report and the medical examiner views this report in conjunction with all the other investigative information and information observed at autopsy. And that's when the final conclusion either a drug overdose or not is proven.
Mm-hmm. And what is this workload like for you? I know that with so many more bodies to examine from drug overdoses, I know the city is experiencing a major budget crisis right now. And so I imagine you're not getting a lot of new staff to deal with it. So how are you managing?
It's very difficult. I mean, another added factor is our work's a niche. Forensic discipline, forensic pathology is a niche, forensic toxicology. So it's also hard to recruit in general with our work, just because it's not a large working population throughout the country. And so to get qualified, good people can be somewhat challenging. So we already have that factor. And then, yes, of course, with such a challenging year in 2020, it makes it even more difficult. However, in terms of our forensic laboratory testing, we've been fortunate that the city's invested in the last few years ago into a new facility. That's really helped us. We would have been in even a much more worse situation if we were still stuck at the Hall of Justice. But our move to the new facility at the end of 2017 and accompanying equipment and new technologies has allowed us in the last couple of years to actually develop new methodologies that are state-of-the-art and cutting edge, and allowed us to really be a lot more efficient in the work that we do. And so that buffers it somewhat, and that really helps us not get to backlogs that have been observed around the country, and also still do quality work. So we're still finding all the drugs that are involved in the decedent, not just maybe one or two, but we can put together the whole picture. So it is challenging, but we're doing as best as we can, and working as smart as we can, I guess, is probably the best way to put it.
And I know that fentanyl is driving this. Is it usually that people are using drugs laced with fentanyl and they didn't even know that it was in there? Or I know also you just need a tiny amount is a regular dose. Are they taking too much, or what tends to be the problem?
Yeah, there's no one answer or one scenario that fits all of these cases. It seems to be a mix. Definitely now people on the street are using fentanyl intentionally. They know that this is powdered fentanyl. San Francisco for a long time has had black tar heroin, of which other parts of the country haven't. They've had powdered heroin or other forms of opioids. And so that was a lot more difficult to discern between fentanyl and, say, heroin, or fentanyl and another opioid. And that was largely protective for some years. But people on the street now, a lot of them do know that this is fentanyl. However, it is still being mixed with other drugs, and whether it be, again, like I was saying before, crack cocaine or methamphetamine or in counterfeit or medications. We do see those cases still from time to time, but there's really great resources in the people, drug harm reduction agencies and the Dope Project and other agencies like this who are really working with users on the street, and they have a lot of information that they can share about what they think people are using intentionally or not.
And how can you tell when you're doing your investigation, what caused it, if you've told me before, you know, someone may think they're buying a Xanax and it has fentanyl in it, or how do you determine all of that when you're investigating?
Yeah, so one philosophy that you know, I like to undertake, and we bring now to this to our work is, you know, we test for everything all the time. So instead of in those morning meetings I mentioned earlier, where we would get together and start to triage that case, we've moved towards an avenue which is, let's just test for everything all the time on all cases. And that way we're removing the bias. We're also looking for drugs that we may not have found if we were targeting. So, you know, a perfect example is someone who the history from the family might be this person had used methamphetamine regularly. Well, if we just targeted methamphetamine, we would miss, of course, maybe the fentanyl and the other drugs, whether they're illicit or therapeutic, on board. And so we really try to remove that bias completely and test for everything. And so by doing that, even if we have someone who is buying Xanax and buying Xanax off the street, whether that person does use other recreational drugs or not, we'll hopefully find them, and we will find if it's fentanyl or not. And so by that information, we can then say, okay, there's investigative information that says Xanax was purchased and only Xanax, yet we found fentanyl. And then hopefully if we still have part of the Xanax tablet or other evidence of that Xanax tablet, we can actually go ahead potentially and test that to see if it's relevant in that case to determine if that Xanax pill did indeed have fentanyl in that. Now, we used to do that a lot more in previous years because there was a lot fewer of those cases. However, now with let's say crack cocaine and methamphetamine, a lot of those situations, where fentanyl is being used at the same time with the methamphetamine and in the same drug product. And so it's really well known in the community, and drug harm reduction agencies are already working with users on the street to make them aware of, you know, life-saving measures like Narcan. Even if you are a stimulant user, it's really important that Narcan is available for those people.
And what exactly does taking too much fentanyl do to your body to kill it? Like, what do you see happen in the body that, you know, then kills the person?
Yeah, well, the challenging fact with fentanyl is it's identical really to its feelings, and the user's not going to feel much difference to heroin or other opioids. It acts in very much the same way as other opioids like heroin. It's just that it's a lot more potent, which can then, of course, make it a lot more difficult and risky to use and potentially be subject to an overdose. But telltale signs are similar to heroin. So you're going to have people who will start to maybe become lethargic, tired, decreased response. They may start to slump over. And depending on the toxicity, whether it's a survived overdose, which the majority of overdoses are, they do go either survived wherever they are or go to hospital and survive there, or if eventually they do die, they may start to experience a whole range of symptoms. But eventually, if the toxicity is enough where it does cause death, they will experience what we call central nervous system depression, which really means their respiratory rate, so that their lungs will start to stop breathing, and that's essentially how they will die.
Wow. And I know some of your colleagues are responsible for the horrible job of calling the family to inform them that their loved one has died of a drug overdose. And what do they tell you about that experience?
Yeah, I mean, it's really difficult. And a lot of the time, families are maybe unaware of drug use. They may be aware of some drug use, but not other parts of drug use. So they have a really difficult time in having to be that first person to relay some terrible news to family, and it's every day, right? And you know, there's situations where the people might be estranged and they haven't been in contact with family for some time, and so even just the effort to sometimes contact family can be challenging, if there's family at all to be contacted. There's also situations, and sometimes I'm involved, where I try to explain that drug products on the street are not regulated. They have different potencies, different levels of purity, so to speak. Explaining that not only can the purity of the drug be different, and that's how come maybe their loved one has overdosed, but also even if they thought they were using a certain drug, or the family thought that the individual was using a certain drug, often we find evidence that a person might be using recreational drugs for some time, and that may not be known to the family always either. Mm-hmm. So it's a very tough and sensitive subject. Here at the department, we're just we're trying to really help them get through that, give them the right information, and do it as timely as possible, and as caring as possible too.
We'll be right back after a short break. You can support 5th & Mission and the newsroom that creates it by signing up for unlimited Chronicle access at sfchronicle.com/pod. I really appreciate that you're putting out the monthly statistics now, because before, we would go for a long time without finding up-to-date numbers on these deaths. What do you hope that these monthly reports to the mayor and Board of Supervisors and others does? What do you want people to do with this information?
I mean, we really hope it can just be used as really good information for people who are on the front line, having to really have the task of trying to decrease these overdoses on the streets. It's a really difficult job, and there's nowhere around the country which has done it perfectly, around the world which has done it perfectly. There are really good schemes which other people in the city can talk much more better to, but I'm hoping that this information and the demographics that it shows is used to help identify where the resources can be used best, and really highlight in a constructive manner the efforts that are needed to reduce these deaths. A lot of these are, of course, preventable. It's a lot of work, it's a lot of work for the city to do these investigations, and there's their lives at the end of the day, which again, if a preventable would be really good to see if we can have these decrease. And we've seen a lot of strategies in other places work. San Francisco has led many strategies for decades on drug harm prevention, and I think that in some way, because of the testing that we do and because of our thorough death investigation, we present numbers which are higher than our counterparts in other Bay areas. And I think that that's not necessarily just because we're the only county that's experiencing overdoses, but I think that by us doing these monthly reports, we're really shedding a light on that. And I think that it's important to not just think we're isolated in this. I think that we'll find that other counties around California and the West Coast are also experiencing that. And, considering their thorough testing and their timeliness of reporting, they may also observe similar trends.
I don't know how political you want to get, but what do you think that the city should do differently? There's a big debate about what is the proper response to drug dealing in particular, especially the police department says there's 8 known dealers of fentanyl who are the worst culprits in the Tenderloin. What do you think is the right response there?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, one, also just still learning about the city, the community in this country. Just being not from this country, it's even more difficult for me to comment on those type of things. But even in my role, there's better people to comment on that.
I thought I'd give it a shot.
I understand. I will say that I really hope that there is safe injecting houses. They do work. I'm really hoping that can push work. We've seen it in my home country in Australia. There was reduced deaths during that, so I can speak to that, and I hope something like that would play out in the future. I think that's beneficial.
Whereabouts are you from in Australia, and what brought you to San Francisco?
From Melbourne, Australia. Well, San Francisco. So, you know, I was at a conference in 2015 and at a forensic toxicology, the international conference. And I was basically asked by the former director here if I'd be interested in San Francisco. He knew that I was, you know, interested in looking at somewhere else. I'd been working at the Victorian Institute of Forensic Medicine in Melbourne for 10 years. I did my PhD there. I had some great mentors there who really gave me a great understanding and appreciation of our work and our discipline. And I was looking at Europe, actually, to find some work there and move there. But he mentioned San Francisco, and at first I never thought to ever come into the US. But after looking to San Francisco, I actually thought this could work. And with some more encouragement, I looked into, you know, the culture, the food, the coffee scene, and some of the arts. And I found that it's actually not too different to Melbourne and in those respects. And I'm glad I did. It's been a great opportunity. It's a huge challenge here. I really walked into a really big challenge, but, you know, we've been given some great tools with a new facility and some equipment. And so we're trying to do the best work we can and hopefully have a leading forensic facility in the country. So that's what kind of brought me to San Francisco. It's really funny how things work out, but I'm super excited to be here. And what I thought might have been just 2 years is now already about 4.5 years. So time flies, and I hope I can continue doing the work.
What prompted you to get involved in this line of work in the first place? It seems like it could be kind of dark and depressing.
You know, I always was always wanted to help people. My sister and I were always wanting to be doctors and help people. And growing up, I thought pharmaceutical science and pharmacy sounded really interesting. And I got into a university degree specific for that. But in my second year, I had a lecture from my now mentor, Professor Olaf Drummer, about forensic toxicology. And I'd never heard about forensic toxicology. I never heard much about forensics. I did not know much about it. I never watched a forensic TV show. And in fact, I don't think I've ever still watched a full episode of a TV show.
I don't think you're missing much.
Okay. I think it would make me a bit depressed considering how well they do. I hear they do very well in 45 minutes time.
It's always resolved.
Yeah, so their turnaround times beat ours by a long shot. I listening to this lecture, I was fascinated. And so instead of my following year was a full year as an intern and at the university, and I opted instead to go with Big Pharma to opt for this one position that was available at the Forensic Institute. And luckily, after interviewing, they gave me that intern position, and I never left, and I always maintained a position throughout my university degree there, and then became a forensic toxicologist, undertook my PhD, and really just I found it really fascinating. I found it fascinating to see what drugs can do on a toxicity level. On you know, we know about the benefits of drugs and how they help with disease and medicine, but for me, it was really fascinating to see the flip side of that and to be involved with that.
Great. Well, you've survived my serious questions, and now it's time for our lightning round.
Great.
Where in the city is your favorite place to get a burrito?
Ooh, a burrito. My wife picked out a great place, and we really enjoy it. I think it's called, what is it called? I think it's called El Taqueria.
In the Mission?
In the Mission, yes, on 16th, I think it is, or around there, yeah. El Taqueria, that's our favourite spot. We just drive past it, and if there isn't a big line, that's when we usually try to stop in.
Yeah. I know these questions are hard because you're pretty new to the to the city and the States, but just do your best. What is your favourite movie filmed in San Francisco?
Favourite movie? Really, I think before moving here, all I knew of was Pursuit of Happiness and... And I think it's The Rock, right, is the other one.
Yeah, Sean Connery.
Yeah, that's the one. But I think recently there was a movie that came out, and I forgot the name. It was a smaller film, and it was actually around, I saw it filmed around the Bayview.
Last Black Man in San Francisco?
Last Black Man in San Francisco. Yeah, that's probably my favorite favorite ones so far.
Those are all three good.
Yeah, and you know, I just learning about the city and seeing some of those the footage and seeing really how knowing you know some of the people and how things are here. It was really fascinating to watch that.
Yeah, it's a good one. Where's your favorite place in the city to get a stiff drink?
Can I defer to breweries?
Yeah.
That's great. Yeah, I love the fact that there is such a strong brewery culture, and I love how locals really want to support local small business, and particularly brewing in that breweries. And so I love visiting Laughing Monk, the local, which is on Bluxome Street, and even Speakeasy. They're probably three of my favorites to see what new beers they have rotating on the taps.
What is the biggest difference between Australia and the United States?
Well, great question. You know, the east coast of Australia, Melbourne and Sydney cities, and the west coast of the US are very similar in many ways. The people, I feel like they're very similar, and even in part of the whole US. I think that Australians and Americans have a real strong bond, and the Americans are always so welcoming, particularly if you're from out of the country. I often feel like they're you know, welcome and love to chat and talk about where you're from. So the similarities is probably that open to chatting and being hospitable in that scenario. Mm-hmm. I find that less of a culture shock. Also, I think particularly here in San Francisco, and this is what I guess really encouraged me to move here, was, you know, again, the food scene, having a good proper food scene that's multicultural. Yeah. Melbourne's very multicultural. We have access to a lot of great food, and San Francisco really benefits from that too. But San Francisco has, you know, much better Mexican and Central and South American food. So Peruvian, I fell in love with Peruvian food. So yeah, that's been really fantastic.
Nice. And last question, what is something you always make sure to squeeze into your busy day?
Whew. I think it's I need to go out and play some basketball. just get out and actually move my body a bit and shoot around. That's been really fun. I enjoy it. It's also a good opportunity to meet people down at the basketball court and sort of relax and de-stress that way.
Yeah, I'm sure you need it after your work day. Well, thank you so much for joining me. It was nice to talk to you.
Thanks so much, Heather.
Thank you to Dr. Luke Rada for joining me today, to King Kaufman for producing this episode, and to you for listening.